Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, superconnector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. As a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. And I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Rob Turchek. Rob is one of the world's most prolific creators of interactive content, having created breakthrough entertainment experiences on every digital platform, including satellite television, game consoles, broadband internet, interactive television, and mobile networks. Over the course of his 20-plus year career, Rob has launched startup ventures and served in executive leadership roles at major media companies, most recently as president of digital media at OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network, and previously as SVP of digital media at Sony Pictures Entertainment. In 2009, he was named one of the 25 executives to watch by Digital Media Wire, and Variety has named him one of the digital dozen most influential players in new media. Rob's first book, Vaporized, Solid Strategies for Success in a Dematerialized World, comes out tomorrow, September 15th. Welcome to the show, Rob. It's great to have you.
Hi, Kelly. I'm happy to be here.
One of the things I overlooked mentioning in the intro was how long we've known each other. We've been colleagues as fellow pioneers and, you know, soothsayers, if you like, in terms of navigating and helping direct people as to what comes next in the digital age for quite some time. And I've always known you to be right at the tip of the spear and always spot on in terms of your vision of where things are headed.
Well, that's awfully nice to hear. Thanks.
It's true enough. But, you know, before we dive into the book, which, of course, is really what I want to spend some time talking about today, Rob, I want to start by dialing back and asking about having a trusted advisor in your life, in your work. It's so important, and I wonder who some of the mentors and advisors have been along the way for you and whether you've also mentored others.
Oh, yeah, that's an important part. You know, it's important for anybody who wants to succeed or improve to have a mentor. The way I approach it is a little bit different, but let me tell you about it because you might be interested to hear about it. I think of it as having a personal board of directors, and I think it's a good idea to have a couple of people who you're accountable to. And they can be friends, they can be older or younger, but they're people who hold you accountable to the goal that you set out. So I do two things. At the end of every year, I sit down, I take a day at the end of the year, and I look back at the year, and I say, did I get all the stuff done that I set out to do? And if the answer is yes, that's great, then I look at each thing that I did. If the answer is no, I look at the things where I didn't quite get there and ask why, try to find out why. But then the second thing I do is I take a look at all the stuff I did, and I say, great, now do I want to do any more of that, or do I want to do something different? And if you have a board of directors, it could be two people, three people, it doesn't really matter, just that they hold you accountable. You're going to express your goals to them. You're going to say, this is what I'm going to get done this year. These are my goals for the year. And at the end of the year, they look at your goals and they see how you did and they ask you about it. Some of the mentors that I have are very specific to something I'm learning about. So, for instance, when I wanted to get good as a public speaker, I went to Tim Sanders, who's a fantastic mentor. He's younger than me. He's a smart guy. He's a great speaker. He's world class.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know him because he's a digital guy and a music guy.
Sure.
And he holds me accountable, and he's great because he always gives me one piece of advice. He doesn't give me two or three. He gives me one piece of advice. But it's always something that's really hard, and it's kind of like the next level I have to take my own speaking to. And under his mentorship, I've improved tremendously, and that's been great for me.
Kinda
I've also
like,
been a mentor to many people,
curly
and I've enjoyed
in the-
that as well.
I'm sorry, Rob. It's kind of like Curly in the City Slickers movie where he kept saying, one thing. It's the one thing.
That's exactly it. If you give people too many goals, they're not going to get them done. Like, simplify it. Make it simple. You can always have a new goal. You know, if you get one done, you can aim for the second one.
Well, I think you're saying a lot about accountability, and, of course, that's critically important when it comes to having a trusted advisor, mentor, a board, whatever. But
yeah.
Also, I think if you're traveling, you're a time traveler, and if you're navigating new terrain that you haven't crossed and traversed before, it also helps to have someone by your side help strategize and plot the course. Wouldn't you agree?
That's true. And there, it's good to have multiple perspectives. So it's good to have advisors or mentors from different fields.
Yes.
Particularly in multimedia. You know, the field that you and I have worked in, digital media, evolves constantly. It never seems to stay the same for more than a year, sometimes 6 months. And so you really want to have a lot of different people's input from different fields, because it's a little bit of each one of those things. Sometimes it's more like the way music works. Sometimes it's a little bit more like the way the movie business works. Sometimes it's not like any of those. It's more like software or games. So it's great to have mentors in all those fields, because then you can get different perspectives.
Now, I am curious. I want to delve into the book a little bit now, because I just love it. It's fantastic.
Thanks.
And, of course, it comes out tomorrow. I've had the privilege of reading it a little bit in advance. And I feel like I want to dive in. I guess my first big question, Rob, is what caused you to write this, and why now?
That's a good question. The request came from many of the companies that I advise. I provide consulting or advisory services to dozens of companies. Some of them are the biggest media companies in the world, like Time Warner.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's little tiny startup companies, but often I'll prepare presentations for them to share with them what I think is going on in the world from my perspective. I travel a lot. I work in a lot of different fields, from games to various kinds of entertainment to even now some government services, education, and so on. So I got a lot of different perspectives. And every time I do that, people say, why don't you write a book? You should put that in a book. So I sat down to write a book, and I realized, man, I have a lot of material. I started out with 400 pages. I had to cut that back in half.
and it's still over 300, which is long for a book.
It is long. Sorry about that.
What I try to do is make each chapter
self-standing.
Packed.
Yeah, it is packed. It's full. There's a lot of stuff in it. Yeah, it's true.
And so you use the term vaporized, which is a fantastic word, to refer to how material goods are being replaced and have been replaced by disintermediation, digital information.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about the historical trajectory that you and I have blazed the trail of that has led us to this point.
Sure. I mean, the word vaporized, it's a funny word. I get that. Sometimes people ask me what it means. And on one level, it means we're making things disappear. Literally, physical objects are disappearing in our lives. You know, when we use that word vaporize as a verb, you think of a science fiction movie where, you know, somebody shoots a ray gun at an object
yes.
and it disintegrates in a puff of smoke.
Yes.
Well, today you can make things disappear, but you don't need a ray gun to do it. All you need is a smartphone.
Right.
If you think about your smartphone, not only does it have access to music services and photos and social networks and all that kind of media, now you can stream video to the phones and so forth, not only does it vaporize physical media, but it actually vaporizes physical stuff. We don't carry cameras around anymore. We don't have to carry around a notepad anymore. We don't
right.
carry a game console. You know, not too long ago, people carried around Game Boys if they wanted to play video games. That's over. Like, that business is completely gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now what we've seen is the consumer electronics companies that make those devices, they've seen double-digit decreases year after year after year on the sale of those devices, because as people move to smartphones, they move away completely from buying those things. So the term I use in the book is demand destruction, which is used to be a relatively rare thing in economics. They would usually use it to talk about someone who buys an electric car will no longer buy gasoline. They don't need it, so they don't go to a gas station. So we've destroyed their demand for gasoline. The electric car destroys demand for gasoline. Okay,
right.
So that's a pretty simple concept, but it's pretty rare in practice to have something supplant an entire category like that.
I loved working at Apple for so many reasons for the bulk of my career in corporate, but the main reason was because I shared with Steve, who I was fortunate to call a personal mentor, Steve Jobs, I shared with him the disintermediation vision of whole industries.
Hmm.
I can remember in the mid to late 90s, saying that because of what we were doing at Apple, we were going to disrupt multiple industries like dominoes, including publishing. That was our goal. We did it.
Well, people use that term disruption quite a lot. In my view, the word's overused now, because disruption, for a lot of people, is just innovation of any sort, and they're missing the essence of disruption. Disruption is really when you can find a much cheaper substitute for an expensive product.
Well, then let's call it something like my history working with Todd Rundgren. His favorite word was recontextualization. And I love that word. Because I think that's really another word for what we're talking about. It's another word for disintermediation, but it presents the information in a new way, recontextualization.
Sure. Okay, that's a very fancy word, sure.
I love that word.
Yeah, I love it too.
But in any event, whatever you call it, I think what we're saying is whole industries are disappearing overnight, as
yeah.
are devices, as are the way of doing things, as are economic models.
Yes.
Because
so
of
when
innovation.
It comes to vaporized, what we're talking about is using information as a substitute for physical stuff, and that's a pretty big idea.
Yeah.
Not your technical disruption. It's different from that. It does involve this idea of demand destruction. But what
Indeed.
Vaporized means is now we can use information as a substitute. And that means we should be able to produce things for much cheaper, provide them much cheaper. And, of course, again, we have that experience in our smartphone every day because you can download stuff for free or at most an app costs a couple bucks. So there's super cheap access to services and information services, I should say. That's a gigantic shift. Now, the other reason I use the term vaporized is that we're in sort of the third phase here where, you know, in the past, if you wanted information, you had to buy a book or some physical medium.
Right.
Then we had broadband, and broadband came along, dial-up internet, and then broadband. That gave us information as a liquid where it was freed from the pages of the book or from the disk, and now it's delivered over a pipeline, kind of like the way you would deliver plumbing, you know, like where you deliver fresh water to a house or electricity. It was information as a utility. And then with the jump to the mobile phone, we now got information as atmosphere. And so the information is freed from its physical constraint. It's all around us. It's available at any given time. If you are in a situation where you need an app, you just pull out your phone, touch, download that app instantly, and it comes to you. So that's the experience of having an information as atmosphere.
And I think you have a great analogy in the book about when we all took science in grammar school, mm-hmm. the science professor used water to illustrate that, right? How it went from a solid as ice to liquid as water to vapor.
Yeah, information exists in the same three states. It can be a solid like a book. It can be a liquid like information through a broadband pipe. And it can be information as atmosphere, information as vapor. And, of course, when you think about it that way, that's a good metaphor. You can push the metaphor a little bit more further. Information bound in a book is very, very stable, right? Those books will last hundreds of years. A Gutenberg
mm-hmm.
Bible can still be read if you read Latin. So it's very stable, but it can't be shared because only one person can use a book at a time. So it's not very flexible. You can't change it or update it because it's written down and printed on a page. So information as a solid has some advantages, but it's very slow. It's very hard to change. It's very expensive. Information as vapor moves just like vapor. It moves very quickly. It's very, very malleable. It's changing constantly. It circulates constantly, and it can be shared by everybody. Those are completely different dynamics. And of course, in the book, I go deeply into the economics of that too because they're profound.
Yeah, exactly right. You're disrupting whole industries. And I love that. I mean, we could play with semantics about what words to use, but I do love that. Of course, I love it because I'm proud of having done it throughout my whole career like you have. Now, looking forward, you argue that many familiar fixtures of our lives, Rob, not just retail stores, but hotels, higher education, healthcare, wellness, all about to be vaporized. Tell us about the constellation of new technologies that makes this vulnerability inevitable for these industries.
Well, in the case of healthcare and education, we're in an economic bubble. Those businesses are overpriced, or I should say we pay too much for what we get.
Yes.
And whenever that happens, that means that industry is vulnerable to your classic disruption. That's a great case for disruption to happen.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's an argument it's going to happen in both those fields. What I'm arguing is that it's going to happen via the mobile phone. So the smartphone is going to come in and find a way to give us access to healthcare information cheaper, healthcare services cheaper, substitutes for education cheaper. And there's many examples of this. In the book, I have hundreds of examples of companies that are developing this. What's most
interesting?
And again,
you have whole cultures and countries
yeah.
that are leapfrogging legacy because they never had any, and they're going right to mobile.
That's certainly true. If you look at Africa, the innovation in mobile payments is all happening in Africa. And the innovation in mobile remittances is happening in East Asia, particularly in the Philippines. And that's because the mobile phone is the computer that those people have. They don't have infrastructure for landline telephony or landline broadband, so they're going to rely on their mobile phone. And as everyone upgrades to a smartphone, they're going to have access to better and better services. So we're seeing innovation happen in those places in the world that have the worst telecom infrastructure.
Right. And it makes sense that they didn't have anything. So, of course, they're going with the hottest thing they can use that solves all their problems
Right here in the United States, it's happening. So here's a great example. While I was writing the book, I got a text message from my insurance company saying it's flu season. Who wants to go to a doctor's office where there's about a bunch of sick people in the waiting room? Who wants to be exposed to that? I thought, not me. I sure don't want to do that. They said, don't do it. You can use our mobile app to talk to a doctor. Just touch this icon, download this app, and you can actually fill out a quick questionnaire. It's like an automated survey, and then they route you to a doctor. If you answer the questions in a way that seems like you really do have bad symptoms, they'll put a doctor on a video call with you right there on the spot.
And, of course, for those of us that hate needles and injections, it's not hard to imagine, it's not science fiction, that at some point you're going to have touch sensitivity on those smartphones where there will be a vapor medication transferred through your finger, and you don't have to get a prick or a shot or go anywhere.
In a way, though it's not connected to a smartphone, that's one of the things that's already happening. There's new ways to do blood tests, for instance. A woman named Elizabeth Holmes has started a very successful company that's doing a new way to do blood tests where they don't prick you with a needle.
There you
go. And it's a little tiny gizmo, just like, you know, it's a miniaturized gizmo, just like a smartphone that's doing it. We're finding ways to put labs, entire labs on a smartphone, you know, so you can now go out in the field and do tests when there's a contagious disease happening. They can do field tests, and they can take tissue samples or swabs from a cheek, for instance, and test someone's tissue right there on the spot. They don't have to send it back to a lab. So that gets us instant results. It'll save some lives. I guess the point is that you can pretty much find a way to substitute the mobile phone and some information service for some part of every single business that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. In my book, I make the argument that cars are one of the things that are most vulnerable, the automobile. And one of my clients is a big Detroit automaker, and they laughed when I told them this. They said, that's absurd. It's ridiculous. And I pointed out to them that we passed peak car ownership in 2008. Young people don't necessarily need to have a car, particularly if they live in a city, because they've got an app that gives them transportation on demand.
That's right.
Doesn't work for everybody, but for people who are in the right city with the right commute, the right distance, and so on, a combination of a bike, a mobile phone, and transportation on demand can actually satisfy your need, and you don't have to actually buy a car or lease a car. And there's plenty of people who blog this topic. This is not news. Plenty of people have written about it, how they're giving up their car. They're not leasing a car because they modeled it out. And over the course of the year, it's cheaper for them to Uber and use public transport.
Yeah, in a place like San Francisco, there's no place for them to park, and they can't afford the insurance anyway.
Exactly right. When you add it all up, the gas, the insurance, the registration, all that stuff, at the end of the year, the parking, it's like renting another apartment for your car.
Exactly.
It's too expensive. So the economics work better. I'm in L.A. Uber's pretty cheap here, but it is sometimes a very long distance. So in a city like L.A., some people are going to stick with a car, and that's fine until we get to robots, which is vaporized labor. And when you have robot cars cruising around, all of a sudden that's going to change everything.
You bet. But very few people have the vision that you and I have to be willing to look in the crystal ball and embrace this whatever we're going to call it, this intermediation, because it's scary to too many people. They can't relate to something they haven't seen yet.
It's true. Well, in fact, in the book, I talk about that as well, right? And you've read that part where I go into denial. I've dealt a lot with the TV industry and television. There's been a culture of denial about the Internet for many years. And TV's done a heroic job of fending off the Internet and protecting its business. So in some respects, you can sort of see how they arrived at that. But what they missed completely was the smartphone and mobile video. I launched mobile video, the very first mobile video services, in 2000. And at the time, my friends in the TV business thought I was crazy because they couldn't imagine how you could put a TV show on a mobile phone. Well, here it is 15 years later, and it's quite a common habit for people to watch Netflix, to stream Amazon Prime to their mobile phones. In fact, they're doing it in the living room, right where the TV set is. We're finding that we're now spending more time on our phones than we spend on our TVs, and that's a giant shift for consumer behavior. Television is America's favorite habit, so it's a really big deal when the mobile phone comes and supplants TV. That's happening right now, and
Absolutely.
It's causing a kind of a shock in the TV industry, because until now they could deny that this was a factor, that they could deny that mobile was going to erode their business in any way. But this year we saw every single indicator hit. You know, the advertisers are moving money out of television and into digital at huge, huge amounts. The ratings for TV shows are down. The number of people subscribing to pay TV, that's starting to taper off as well. So we're starting to see real evidence that people are moving away from that old TV business towards digital.
And extended from that, the cable companies, in terms of having to pay exorbitant fees, when you only want to watch five channels a month, this was what Phil Weiser tried to do a decade ago with Sesame, as you'll recall.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't the right timing for that.
Too early. Yeah, that's right. It was the right idea, wrong time. That happens a lot.
But we're going to see that happen now, and that disruption.
Well, one of the biggest shifts, though, Kelly, is the tablet. That was really the turning point. People didn't see that. We could do video on a computer in 2006. You could get a perfectly adequate video stream if you had broadband. But that wasn't when video online took off. It was really a little bit early, even as recently as 2007, 2008. It wasn't until 2010, and the reason is the form factor. Nobody wants to sit in front of a computer in their home office or their den. They want to sit in the living room where the TV set is, and the tablet lets you do it. In fact, the tablet lets you take the video wherever you want. You can be on the porch, you can be in bed,
playing.
And people use it that way. We know that from consumer behavior. Most video consumption on tablets happens in the house, but people like the flexibility and the personal nature of it. It makes TV personal to you.
Exactly.
So we've seen a big shift here. TV is no longer the first screen. TV has become the second screen.
And that's
very often
funny.
You see people multitasking in front of a TV, and they're using their phone, they're using their tablet to Facebook, to look at a blog, to surf the web, or even watch a video stream while the TV is on in the background.
Yeah, it's funny because 4 years ago we called it second screen, meaning that they're actually watching, they're actually on a laptop or a cell phone while they're watching TV. But now it's actually flipped to the benefit of the tablet.
That's exactly it. So the mobile phone is the first screen. That's a really big deal. So when I set this out in the book, what I did is I used TV as a kind of analogy, and I asked the reader to think about their own business. And I set out all the reasons why the TV companies were complacent and somewhat in denial about this change, and then the consequences of that. And then I say, now imagine your own company and your own industry. Is there an element of the same kind of denial going on, and what might you do to elevate people's awareness? And I also point out to them that if that's going on, almost always, there's always some small startup company on the periphery that's thinking about it in a brand new way, and that's the company you got to watch out for.
You bet, or several of them, yeah.
That's what the CEOs talk to me about. So a lot of times I'll work with CEOs of companies, and they'll say, look, I don't need you to help me with my current competition. I know who the companies are. I know their products. I'm not concerned. We're doing great. What you've got to help me figure out is where are the companies coming from that I don't even know exist, these new companies that come out of the woodwork that use technology, particularly mobile technology, to completely undermine our business. That's what they're worried about. And, one of the places they're most concerned about.
Yeah, it's not just the companies, it's also the ways of doing business that shift.
Yeah, that's true, because the mobile phone changes us as a consumer, right? It changes our expectation. Once you've had a smartphone and you've gotten used to it and you get in the habit of looking at it 100 times a day, then everything else that you look at in the world seems defective. The TV set, you just can't believe how cumbersome it is to pick up a remote control and scroll through a square menu. It seems ridiculous. When on a mobile phone, I go straight to the app I want, touch it, boom, and it launches. I don't have to scroll through anything on a phone. And so we wonder, why can't the TV be more like the telephone?
True.
Well, Apple's going to do that now with the new Apple TV. They're going to completely reinvent the way you navigate television, and I think that's a big deal.
It is a big deal, and the bomb just dropped last week, and I don't think too many people caught it.
Yeah, a lot of people dismissed the announcements last week, but I think they don't really get the importance of it. First of all, it's the first round, right? The next round of Apple TV is going to have 4K built into it. It'll probably improve upon the configuration that they're launching this fall. But there's a really important piece. Apple focused on discovery and what Ben Horowitz calls a permissionless app store. That's really important because until today, previous to today, everything that appeared on your TV screen was there because someone had to get permission for it.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, you couldn't just put a TV show up on television. You had to go through a network or a channel or a distributor like a cable company or satellite company. There wasn't just possible for anybody to make their own TV show. Sure, you could do it on the web. People were doing that. Increasingly, they're doing that. And increasingly, they're getting a big audience. what Apple's going to do is they're going to open it up, and you're going to see now that a show from NBC or a show from Fox isn't going to be any more privileged or have any more pride of place than a show coming from the internet. It could be a show on YouTube, could be a show from Netflix or something. That's a giant shift. That's
it
an
is.
Enormous change, and I think a lot of people missed that in the Apple announcement. They're going to reconfigure the way power works in the TV industry. They're going to pull power away from the programmers and put it in the
exactly
hands of
right.
consumers.
It's loss of control for the TV programmers, and that's never happened before. It's the last bastion of, to fall in terms of
yeah.
all the different media types.
And I don't think they're really ready for it. Their cost structure right now is built around channels, and channels generate a hell of a lot of money.
That's
so if
right.
you start to unbundle TV and sell individual shows, well, you know this better than anybody because you saw what happened firsthand in the music business. Once you unbundle the album, suddenly the music industry is worth 25% of what it had been before.
And dropping, yeah.
If that happens to TV, that's going to be an enormous challenge for Los Angeles because so much of Los Angeles' economy depends on the television industry.
Well, and a huge opportunity for folks like you and me to be navigators and help them find their way to the next way to do business, you know?
Yeah, it's true. I think navigation and discovery is going to be a gigantic opportunity because as soon as you unbundle, you have a new problem, which is how do I find anything? Channels.
And how do
channels
I reach
helped us with that problem. But
yeah,
we're going away from channels now to app stores, and that means there's going to be a giant discovery problem. That's a great opportunity for creativity and reinvention.
So if you were still running OWN Digital Focus these days, how would all of this be impacting your thinking?
Well, when they first talked to me about joining them, I said, look, would you launch, it's the 21st century, would you launch a cable channel or would you launch a digital multimedia programming service that spans everything? I think today just about every channel is trying to think that way. Some are better at it than others. Not every channel is able to do it because they can't clear all their content for all those platforms.
Certainly true.
But that's the reinvention challenge that the TV industry has. But Kelly, it's not limited to that. It's not limited to TV. Think about a totally different industry like retail.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk to retailers, I say, hey, you have the same challenge that TV has. You have to think omni-channel as well. Because a retailer thinks, well, I've got a store. That's the prideful place. That's the main thing. And then we also have a website, and we also have a mobile thing. And those are small. And I'm like, well, no, that's the wrong way to look at it. You're omni-channel. You have to be on every device optimized for that device, optimized for the way the consumer wants to find stuff on that device.
And it's not optional.
I mean, you got to cater to every, you know, your customers are everywhere now. They're coming from every
right.
different point. So the mentality has to be omni-channel. So that's easy to say, but now take a look at that organization, whether it's a TV company, a retailer, a bank, or any other company. Company organizations are all built around the channel. So you have a group that runs the retail group and another group down the hall or in another building that runs online and yet another group that runs mobile. That's crazy because you're never going to have that proper synchronization. It's one customer across all those channels, and that customer wants to be treated with respect, greeted, understood, met well. Whether they switch, you know, their journey might start on a mobile phone, it might start with a billboard, it might start in a shopping mall, it might end up with a purchase in a store or on the e-commerce platform. It could happen in any path whatsoever because consumers have a lot of ways in now. If you're omni-channel, you're good with all of it, and you can.
And that's why Apple has. And that's why Apple has showcased a model for doing that, albeit a closed ecosystem, but that is exactly what that was intended to show.
That's right. That's right. But a lot of people haven't caught up with that thinking. And that is organizational change. It's not just, you know, we have to change the way we present our stuff to consumers.
No.
That's an organizational change because behind that presentation, behind those channels, is a whole big organization for each one of them and a supply chain and so forth. Now we have to think about it completely differently. So what you'll probably see with companies is a big shift. My expectation is we're going to start to see companies change meaningfully where the senior management team will be not just aware of digital, they'll be conversant and expert in digital. And we're starting to see that happen in two very interesting places. First of all, Warner Brothers Studios appointed Kevin Sugihara about a year ago to become the head of the studio. He wasn't a film guy.
As we know,
he was the guy that ran the digital. He ran new media.
Yeah.
And the reasoning was very simple. Like, that's where the growth is going to be. We want that guy leading us into the future. We don't want some old film studio guy leading us into the future. We don't
and
want somebody
big, in. As the big labels have consolidated, record labels, who have they put in charge in senior positions at last? A little too late to the party, but it's digital guys.
Digital, because that's where all the growth is.
That's
and
right.
We're seeing the same thing happen in media buying agencies. So in the past, in the media buyers, you would have, traditional media buying across, broadcast, radio, print, and so forth, and then you had a little digital team. Well, now three of the biggest media buyers have appointed their digital people to be the head of the company for the same reason. That's where all the growth is going in the future. And so the old platforms can be managed, but you're mainly managing the decline. And what you're trying to focus on is growth, so you want to put your smartest minds in the growth area. That's digital, and increasingly it's mobile.
And so for full circle to my question about you and Owen, had this been today that they brought you on, you would probably be running the company as the digital guy.
Yeah, well, candidly, I don't think the time for me to join a cable channel is now in my life.
I grant you that, but I'm just saying, based on everything we've just discussed, you'd have actually been leading the direction of the company as opposed to just being the head of digital, which in and of itself was a huge position.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
So Seth Godin has actually called your book an urgent manifesto, Rob, for those in the information business, and he claims that everyone's in the information business. Do you agree with that assessment?
You know, he's absolutely right. I was really thrilled when he read the book and he offered that. I thought, well, that's a great comment because it's so true. Who's not in the information business? You know, I say everybody's in the media business. And what happened to the media companies is going to happen to banks and financial services and insurance and all kinds of producers of physical products. They don't see it that way, but here's why. As more and more people spend more and more time in front of digital screens, on average, we spend 10 or 11 hours a day staring at digital screens, whether they're at work, in your car, at home, the TV, your phone. All these things add up to about 10 or 11 hours a day of time. That's more than we spend sleeping. So if people are spending that much time there, then companies also have to find a way to spend that kind of time in front of their customers. They can't wait for the people to walk into their physical shop.
That's right.
And so they have to retool and focus on that. So in a way, we're all becoming digital media companies. I think Seth's absolutely right. And he said it's an urgent manifesto, and I agree with that too. And I'm really glad he wrote that because I think that's a big point. This is not a thing you can kick down the road anymore. You know, 10 years ago, I could talk to a TV company and say, hey, guys, you got to really pay attention to what's going on with the music and print business. But now that 10 years is gone.
And I remember sitting 10 years ago in the office of heads of major studios, heads of digital, major film studios, and they would actually have on the whiteboard, some of them would actually have, note what happened to the record labels. But they didn't do anything about it.
But they didn't. As recently as 2011, Jeff Bukas, who runs Time Warner, was saying, we're not the music industry. It's morning in cable land, you know. So these guys didn't get the memo. They got the memo and they sat on it for 10 years. They did nothing to actually be prepared for this. They had no plan B for what happens when you unbundle television. They still don't.
And they don't think necessarily that it's going to happen. It'll just happen on the music side. That won't happen to us. You know, that's an ostrich mentality.
For the people who are listening, the takeaway here is it will happen to every industry. It will happen to every industry. This wave is rippling like a seismic wave through the entire economy. So what happened to music, what happened to print publishing, magazines, newspapers, and books is happening now to television, and it will occur in your business. Whatever can be turned into information will be. Whatever can be vaporized will be. Whatever can be turned into a mobile app and downloaded on your phone will be. If it can be streamed to a phone, that will happen. If you don't do it yourself, someone else is going to do it to you.
That's for sure, and we have a great example coming up, I think October 9th. I'm not entirely sure of that date. Tom Hanks' son, Colin Hanks, and I know you know this, Rob, has produced a documentary on the demise of Tower Records.
Oh.
and that comes out. And it's going to be, like, duh for people like you and me, but for a lot of people it's going to be a real eye-opener.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, you know, in my book I start with Tower Records as my example in the beginning.
Brought it up. That's why I brought it up. It's phenomenal. It's a great example. It's a bellwether.
Amazing. Oh, I did not know that was coming out. I can't wait to watch it.
I want to say October 9th, but I could be off on a week on that. So, you know, of course this is going to affect us all as a society, but now I want to ask you something. I know you do the same thing I do. I actually walk around as an observer, and I notice how everyone is always in front of their smartphone. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to be said about that in terms of killing interactivity between people and all that. But I wonder if you think that by interacting less with our physical environment, will everyone become like millennials with their eyes glued to their smartphones at every available moment? And if so, what are the implications of that for the basic idea of community and interactivity between people?
Kelly, you say that like it's a bad thing.
wondering where your head's at with that.
We have to be a little careful here because there's a possibility that the two of us are going to come off as those middle-aged curmudgeons who are going like, you know, those damn kids, they're always looking at their phones.
No, it's not just kids, obviously. I did use the word millennials, but you see it even with couples, adults.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, television's an addictive behavior. Reading can be an addictive behavior. Certainly the mobile phone is an addictive behavior. That's true. So the recommendation there is be aware of that. You know, don't get sucked into the point where you're ruining your relationships. But that said, there's a reason why people do this. There's a reason why they do it. And actually, it's Mark Zuckerberg who figured this out, and he's smart about it. He said, look, there are transaction costs to being in touch with people. He doesn't mean money. He means time and friction and energy and some emotional effort to stay in touch with people.
Right.
And so what he tried to do when he designed Facebook was reduce those transactional costs to make it simpler, easier to stay in touch. So I can just click the like button. And all that does, it's just a little heartbeat that lets my friend know that I saw the thing, I thought it was cool, I didn't have to write a whole long thing, I didn't have to, you know, send them a note or something about it. They just posted pictures of, you know, their kid going back to school, and I can click like, and it's just a low-friction way for me to interact. So I think what we're starting to see is that I can interact with a lot more people through social media and through the mobile phone than I can in my physical world. And so it's going to change the nature of relationships. Certainly for me, I use social media aggressively, and I've done it for many, many years, back almost a decade now. Yeah, I was on stuff way before Facebook with Rise, some of the early social platforms, 6degrees. And I use those because I travel a lot and I make friends in different parts of the world and I want to stay in touch with them. But,
right.
You know, people are always changing jobs and they lose their email or they get a new phone and they change the number and then you're out of touch and it's quite hard to reconnect. What social media does is it enables me to kind of maintain connection with people who I haven't seen, in some cases, people I haven't seen in 20 years. And I'm really happy about that. That makes me very thrilled to have a way where if I need to connect with them, I can do it. And I do this all the time. I'll fly into a city, and I'll look and say, who are my friends in this city? I can do that easily on Facebook or on LinkedIn. And then, boom, I can look those people up, and immediately I've got friends to see for dinner. We catch up. I see their kids. It's a great thing to do. So I think what's happening is the nature of social dynamics is changing, but it's not necessarily bad. It's easy to condemn it. It's easy to say, oh, this is terrible, but it isn't. It's always a combination.
No, I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I agree with everything you've just shared. It's just an observation that it's different now, way different in terms
of... It's a little difficult when your kids are in the back seat of the car and they don't talk to you anymore. Yes, that's a weird thing.
Yeah.
But were we so different when we were wearing Walkmans? You know, come on, it isn't really that different. That's generational.
Yeah, there is that. But that was that. You could argue that that was a percentage of the population as opposed to everyone having their smartphone with them at all times.
But here's another way to look at it. People are creating more than ever before. More people are more creative. I know that sounds crazy. But if you think about it, composing a tweet, there's an art to that.
Yeah.
There's an art to doing Instagram. I think more people are learning about photography through Instagram than you know ever before in history. That's not a bad thing. It's subtle and small, you know. And surely the percentage of bad stuff is still very high. There's a lot of crappy video on YouTube. I know, you know, that no one's arguing it's not. But so much content is being created. What's happening is it is making people much more savvy about creativity and applied creativity, and we're much more versatile. You know, nowadays, every young kid coming out of school is quite conversant with creating content on various platforms for various things. That wasn't true 15 years ago.
No. And, you know, obviously there are people who do fear change, and they are extremely unsettled by all of this. But you know, for Internet startup companies, you say this could be the biggest land grab since the gold rush.
Well, I think for the people that are afraid, that's often expressed in the form of resistance and denial, and I speak to that directly in my book. And if you're going to adopt denial, you're going to get scooped by somebody else. That's a real bad thing to do. Like, you mustn't do it. You got to embrace this stuff. One of the things I always make people do when I do workshops at companies is I make them sign up for social media tools and start using them. Don't just talk about it. Get into this. You know, it's not that hard. Little kids can do it. But people tend not to. They tend to be resistant to it. All that means is you're going to become obsolete. And the reason for that is simple. That's where the audience is. So the audience is moving to these platforms really quickly in huge numbers. If you're not there too, then you're just not part of that conversation.
That's right. And you can't necessarily afford to be left behind.
The other thing you can't do is you can't insist on imposing your economics in these new platforms. That's another part of the book that I go into in detail is like, how do these platforms really work and how do you really make money? What are some of the strategies for making money? Because a lot of people don't understand it. They think, well, we're, again, to use TV as example, we make TV shows. We know how that business works, so we'll just run it the same way over here. Well, it doesn't work like that here, and you're not going to make money doing it that way.
No. So
that's
you,
a huge
again,
change.
The book is chock full of practical, pragmatic things to apply. It's not just high concept. So to that end, Rob, for our listeners, could you summarize maybe one or two of your solid strategies for success in the vaporized age?
Yeah, sure. One of the most important ones is in it's in Chapter 5, and it's called What is Your Proprietary Data Asset? What is your proprietary data asset, which is a funny phrase. What that means is it's a data asset that belongs to your company. If you do it right, it grows naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And it grows as more and more people use it. Of course, the good example is Twitter, YouTube, or Facebook, because these things are data geysers. I describe them as data geysers because the more people use them, the more content they create, and they have a data asset that's growing really, really rapidly, and that's a powerful thing. Every search company has a data asset because they know what you're looking for, and that gives them an advantage. They now have a, you know, information advantage over their rivals based on usage. This is really different from the way most companies look at information. Most companies look at information as something that they have to put money into. They have to invest in the creation of it. And so
right.
then they think it's very priceless. It's expensive to them, so they treat it like it's something scarce, and they put barriers around it, and no one else can get access to it, so it doesn't grow. And the only way you can grow that data asset is by pouring more money into it. What the smart companies are doing is they're opening up their data, and they're allowing other people to contribute to it, improve it, comment on it, add metadata to it, and it grows and grows and grows. And so they get, basically, it's like the closest thing to a perpetual motion machine, because the more people who come in, the more data they create. So there's
Absolutely.
A real clear split there. So the first thing I would urge a company to do is focus on what is your proprietary data asset. And it's hard to do, but this is, you know, every industry, I'm convinced, has data at the heart of it. They have a pure information piece. The second thing is, can that data asset be separated from your physical product? Crazy concept, but if you think about it, there's a lot of information around a car. There's the owner of the car, where he likes to go with the car, how much he's spending on the car, and so forth. There's a lot of destination information. There's habits involved. There's work information. Well, guess what? Uber is gathering all that information from the car industry because the car industry is too stupid and not nimble enough to gather it themselves. Uber has the most unbelievable data asset that is growing right now, and they have it about drivers, and they have it about people who like to get driven places.
That's right.
If you think about the information asset that Uber has, it's extraordinary. They did a funny blog post about 4 years ago. They took it down now because it was embarrassing ultimately. They were looking at people who were doing one-night stands, people who were going out for hookups, and they could see somebody would take an Uber to a place at, you know, midnight or 1 in the morning, and then in the morning from that same location, they would get an Uber back to their house. And so that was telling Uber that's a person who's doing a one-night stand, right? It's pretty
yeah.
pretty undeniable, right? You're spending the
yeah.
night somewhere that's not your house, and in the morning you're going back to your house. And so they then started to stack rank the different cities in America to see who had the sexiest nightlife. And Boston came out on top. And it was a great bit. And then, of course, immediately there was a backlash because everybody's backlashing against Uber. But the point there is that these companies are collecting data about our behavior in ways that we're not even aware of. And
right.
they gather it across multiple people, millions of people at once. So they have data assets. And in some cases, you can seize a data asset that belongs to another industry. And I think that's one of the things that Uber is doing to transportation. They're collecting, gathering information that really should have been owned by taxi companies, limousine companies, and car manufacturers. And those companies are too dumb to get it. They just missed it completely. Now Uber has it. And that is going to become a huge advantage for Uber going forward. It'll be very hard to supplant them now that they're number one.
No doubt about it. That's a great example. And I guess I also wonder if you could share maybe the best piece of advice you've ever gotten, Rob, that you might like to pass on to our listeners.
The best piece of advice I've ever gotten in my entire life? Think twice before you say no.
Okay.
Think twice before you say no. When I was a young man, I went over to Europe to study, and one of my older brothers had just gotten back from Japan where he was studying, and that's the advice he gave me. It was all he said. He said, think twice before you say no. Often in life, people will come to you with a proposition that seems a little bit radical, maybe a little bit silly, maybe a little bit risky. And the instinct is to say, nah, I don't want to do that. That sounds weird. That sounds dumb. That sounds like a risk. That might not work. We do this too often. It becomes a habit. And then it becomes a rigid frame of mind that makes us inflexible and unable to change. And that's a gigantic disadvantage in a world that's changing so quickly. So my recommendation for everyone listening and every company that I talk to is think twice before you say no.
Hit the pause button. Boy, that's great, Rob. Well, it's been wonderful to have you. And I guess before we finish our chat, I always like to ask my guests what I think is one of the most important questions of our time together. And that really is, what comes next for you? What's the one project or collaboration as part of your legacy that you haven't yet started but you dream about creating?
Oh, sure. I can talk a little bit about that if we have some time. Sure. So as you know, I'm the chairman of a charity here in Los Angeles. It's the Creative Visions Foundation in Malibu.
Right.
And we do a cool thing. We provide fiscal sponsorship to activists all over the world who are using media, arts and media, to change the world for the better. And one of my jobs as the chairman of the board is to help raise money. And I keep thinking, how can we do this better? It's not very efficient the way it's done today.
Right.
The bane of everyone's existence who's involved in charitable organizations is the effort to raise money is not very efficient. It's a lot of work, and it could be done better. And so, you know, I also have a long background in the gaming industry.
Yes.
In developing games. And so the next project I want to work on is games for charity, ways to raise money using games.
Effectively,
and
crowdfunding using games.
You got it. But you know, crowdfunding is game-like in the sense that you feel like you won something, but you didn't. You just spent $75 on that cool new watch. You spent $75. And not only that, it's kind of risky. You might never actually get the watch. You know,
I tell you, a great
amazing
example is my friend Adam Nimoy just did, I think, one of the most successful crowdfunding campaigns ever in trying to complete a documentary about his dad, For the Love of Spock. And he, in a little over a month, he raised $660,000. His goal was $600,000.
That's fantastic. That's a great story.
And there are
it
a lot
happens
of
all
great
too rarely.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is happening. Crowdfunding, you know, the amount raised there every 18 months doubles. And now they're raising billions in a year. So it's quickly becoming a large funding source. And it's becoming part of the mix of venture and angel round financing. Crowdfunding has a role to play in that. But I want to get beyond that idea of here's a campaign, 30 days, we're going to try to raise this goal against that. You know, it is true, when you get backers, they do feel like they're on your team and they're cheering for you. I want to do something different. I want to do a thing where if you help contribute money and get your friends to contribute money, you get prizes. And the more money you raise, the more prizes you get. That's what I want to do. And it's much closer to a lottery or a bingo kind of game.
Yeah.
And I think it could be a lot of fun. It may be illegal, so I haven't started doing it in the United States. I have to check out, make sure that this is actually
use the
illegal thing.
You got to use the rules and all that stuff. But I never stopped
anybody from starting a business. Talk to the guys
at
Uber.
No, I love the big vision that you have for it. You're always a big vision kind of thinker like myself, so I really resonate with you always when you come out of the woodwork with something like that. And I think you'll get there because you always do. You always achieve your goals.
Well, that's nice of you. Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks again for being here, Rob. I really appreciate you taking the time. I want to thank my listeners, as I always do, for joining us. We'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.